Thank you for the invitation to be with you this morning and for coming out on Saturday morning for this conference to speak of matters which are really close to our heart and close to an understanding of who we are as Anglicans and our understanding of our not only our heritage, and we'll hear more of that from Ashley and from Mark, but to look at what the state of play is, which is the title here. Has everyone got a copy of the outline? That's the first thing I might just... If you'd come in early, you might not have got a copy of it. Everyone's got a copy, I think. Not quite. The Anglican Church of Australia, as you know, is a body defined by the Constitution, 1961. The Diocese of Sydney, or the Diocese of Australia, as it was in the beginning of our of white settlement here, under Archdeacon Broughton as an archdeacon, and then under and then Bishop Broughton at the time, in the middle of the 19th century. And the Diocese of Sydney had various portions then carved out, and so what we are today, although we were the original diocese, what we are today is that we've got 23 dioceses around the nation, and the dioceses are very much independent in as much as any decisions of General Synod have to be decided if they affect doctrine, ritual or discipline, have to be adopted by the diocese. So there's a certain independence of dioceses in Australia. Although there have been general synods since the 19th century, it was not until 61 that we, under a new constitution, we formed the general synod as it currently exists. For those of you who have a knowledge of this, excuse just going over a little bit, but there was a long time, it took many, many decades. The concept of a national church was there at in the early part of the 20th century, and there's a fine book by a fellow called John Davis from Melbourne which gives the history of the Constitution. Basically, in a nutshell, Sydney didn't want to be involved with the rest of the church in a way in which the gospel, as Sydney understood it, would be diminished or diluted. There were great divinities, particularly there were Anglo-Catholic strongholds and there were liberal Catholic strongholds. And there was a resistance from Sydney all the way through. A visit by Archbishop Fisher in the 1950s tried to get the people together. And finally, T.C. Hammond and Archbishop Mole at the time, they were convinced that this was the way forward. And one of the most critical features for them was that before the Constitution, we were connected to canon law in England. There was a consensual compact of Anglican churches in our in the whole nation, but in Sydney, of course. And by that consensual compact, if the law of the Church of England changed, then it would automatically change in the Diocese of Sydney. As we saw the winds, or as Archbishop Mole and T.C. Hammond saw the winds of change in England, they thought it really was better to get a constitution which reflected the Reformation heritage of what it means to be Anglican. Mind you, people like Broughton Knox and Donald Robinson held a contrary view, and they thought that this constitution would bind us too strongly. So in many ways, there is both protection and constraint. If you look at the back of the page there, I've listed for you the chapters 1 and 2 of the Constitution, the first being the Fundamental Declarations and the second Ruling Principles. It's not quite all there. I've just given the main part of the Ruling Principles. I'm often amazed that many Anglican clergy in our diocese aren't actually aware of the Fundamental Declarations of the Constitution. I suppose the Constitution is not your normal bedtime reading for Anglican clergy or Anglican laity. It's probably just bishops. But there you'll see that this is what cemented for Mole and Hammond the fact that if the Anglican Church of Australia, being a part of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church of Christ, holds the Christian faith as professed by the Church of Christ from primitive times and in particular set forth in the creeds known as the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed. Paragraph 2, the Church receives all the canonical scriptures of the Old and New Testaments as being the ultimate rule and standard of faith given by inspiration of God and containing all things necessary for our salvation. We might have reversed the order of those two paragraphs, but nonetheless, at least they're both there. The Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, expressing the Christian faith from early times, but based upon the Scriptures. And this church will ever obey the commands of Christ, teach his doctrine, administer his sacraments of holy baptism, holy communion, follow and uphold his discipline, and preserve the three orders of bishops, priests, and deacons in the sacred ministry. So those are the fundamental declarations. That's what binds us as a national church. That defines us, as it were, with regard to our understanding of Scripture. The ruling principles then are really with reference to liturgical aspects of the Book Common Prayer. I won't read that paragraph. You can read it yourself. And I've left, and it also says how you can deviate from the set forms of the Book Common Prayer through the means of a vestry meeting, etc. But those are smaller details. The main thing there is to see that the 39 articles and the Book Common Prayer, as it were, the authorised forms of worship, and reflect our teaching in the articles and in the Book Common Prayer. The problem is that we have this great understanding, but the dispute is that what has happened since 1961 is what are the commands of Christ, what are his doctrine? Some more strongly hold to the way we administer the sacraments and Holy Communion. So, for example, in other parts of the country, individual cups would be banned in the service of the Lord's Supper as being a departure from the doctrine of Christ. But the doctrine, as seen in the Scriptures, though we hold to that nationally, the question is, what is that doctrine? In other words, how do you apply? What's the hermeneutic for understanding the Bible and its application in 21st Australia? So we have shared commitments, but we have different understandings. Under the Constitution, there was an opportunity to reflect upon how we might introduce a new prayer book. And AAPB, and an Australian prayer book in 1978, was, I think I'm not mistaken, the first English prayer book, in English since 1662. There was the 1928 in England, but it never got passed, and it was not till 1980 that the Alternative Services Book came in England. So in many ways, Australia was a forerunner and with regard to liturgical reform, and AAPB, and our own Donald Robinson was involved in that, was in many ways a conservative rewording of the Book of Common Prayer with Order 1 services, so updated English, and then Order 2 services, a more flexible form of service. One of the interesting things just in the development of language from 78 till 95, when the next prayer book came out, the whole recognition of inclusive language, and where male gender had always been seen to include female gender, there was a move in our society that we really needed to distinguish between that with regard to male and female. So AAPB has for us men and for our salvation in the Nicene Creed, which no one seemed to object to for basically 400 years in English. And then that, so therefore, it becomes for us and for our salvation, which is the APBA version. The problem with APBA was, APBA, without the sure hand of Donald Robinson, no doubt, allowed a whole range of extra things coming in, a whole range of practices and liturgical additions, which the Diocese of Sydney was very uncomfortable with. There was a big debate in the General Synod in that year, and the compromise was that it wouldn't be authorised as a prayer book per se, but it would be authorised as liturgical resources. But it has the title, A Prayer Book for Australia, and that is pretty well in common practice around Australia. You'll find very few dioceses outside Sydney using AAPB, and you'll find very few dioceses outside of Sydney using BCP too, for that matter, the Book of Common Prayer. APBA didn't receive the welcome from our synod in Harry Goodhue's time, and although Harry Goodhue did allow its use if under Section 4 of the Constitution, that's the ruling principles there, if a parish wanted to adopt it, then the Archbishop of the day, Harry Goodhue, allowed that. So APBA is in use in various parts of our diocese. And then, of course, Common Prayer was launched a couple of years ago, not an authorised liturgy because the diocese hasn't got the power to do that, but again a resource which parishes can use, and again if they use Section 4 of the Constitution, they can do that with a clear conscience, or they can just use it with a conscience of their own device. What's happened, of course, is in 61 we had one prayer book. And so whatever church you went to, you'd get the same prayer book. Now, the liturgical reform has given us such a variety that you're not going to get the same service from one parish to another parish in one diocese, let alone from one diocese to another diocese. Sydney has been far more relaxed. Sydney clergy have been far more relaxed in the use of services. Some archbishops have complained in the past of being too relaxed and not enough attention given to the way they structure their services. Common Prayer, and there's a website that goes with that, Better Gatherings, is a way to actually encourage clergy to form their services in a way which are consistent with the principles of our Constitution and the Bible. And there's teaching, obviously, at Moore College with regard to liturgical leading of forming of services, but it's still always going to have rough edges out there. Mind you, even under Book of Common Prayer, there were certain things which were illegal, which took place where no one seemed to worry about. Whenever you had a harvest festival service, that was technically illegal. A collation of archdeacons, there was no authorised form of service for that. Induction services, none of those were authorised. But we just lived in a happy relationship with regard to that, and we all knew what we were doing. Liturgical reform now has a much wider spread and a diversity which exists there, even in our own diocese, which makes it difficult to how you hold on to what are our services week by week, reinforcing for our people the truth of the scriptures, the creeds which we profess, and confessing our sins before God, those elements of the service which, in my view, are quintessentially Anglican, to have Bible, creed, confession, exposition. Hymns came in later. But nonetheless, to have that is important. And I think we live in a day where the uniformity principle is not going to work. There's no point in being legalistic in expressing a uniformity. And we even have canons, general synod canons, which allow the minister to make non-substantial changes to a service. So it all becomes quite legal with regard to doing that, and so their consciences aren't bruised. But the other things which have moved on since 61 is the doctrinal reform. Women's ministry is probably the most obvious and one of the most heated issues in our national church. It began with the movement for seeing women in ordained ministry. There was first a move to see women as priests. That was rejected. So then they went deacons, and then priests, and then bishops. It's a convoluted history. The first two came by legislation. The third came by the opinion of the appellate tribunal. Women's ministry, of course, in the Diocese of Sydney is very old. Our first ordinance goes back to 1922, authorising deaconesses particularly to address congregations. Deaconesses have been there since the end of the 19th century in Sydney, and Deaconess House at one stage was a unique training institution for deaconesses in the world. We still have Anglican Deaconess Ministries. They still hold that title, and although at the moment there are a few deaconesses left in the Diocese of Sydney, none in active service to my knowledge. All of them have retired. So women's ministry has been an issue, and it became a doctrinal reform, because that was seen as consistent with the fundamental declarations. In Sydney, we've held a view that women can be deacons, but not women can't be priests or presbyters, and we hold that because of the teaching of the Bible. And we thought that would have held us together, but it didn't hold us together, because different parts of the church, and you'd have to say a majority of dioceses in the Church of Australia, considered that women in all orders of ministry was permissible with the scriptures. So there's a divide and a distinction which is a doctrinal divide for us. Human sexuality was the next big issue, and not necessarily connected, but there are some connections, particularly in terms of hermeneutics with regard to sexuality. And there's been a slow pressure in the National Church with regard to widening our sphere of understanding sexuality as being so that homosexual practice could be acceptable for Christians as heterosexual practice in marriages, and therefore in some committed relationships, and normally that they speak in that language. I was on the Doctrine Commission for the General Synod for 20 years, and this was a big item of ours in the 1990s. And in the Doctrine Commission, apart from myself and Peter Jensen, all the other members of the Doctrine Commission were in favour of seeing a change of practice, a change of doctrine. Although they all recognised that the doctrine of the Church was that marriage was for a man and a woman, exclusive for life, they were all open and wanted to explore and encourage and foster a change in that. So that was the 1990s. The constitution of the Doctrine Commission has changed, so there would be more evangelicals now in the Doctrine Commission than there were in my time, but that pressure is still there. Divorce and remarriage is an interesting one. We have held in our diocese to only ordaining people who have not been divorced. And so therefore we don't ordain people divorced. That's not true in other parts of the Anglican Church of Australia. It's not true in other parts of the world either. I was a canon theologian in the Diocese of Ballarat, a conservative Anglo-Catholic diocese, but there a number of clergy were in second or third marriages, and that didn't seem to blink an eye with regard to people, to the bishop with whom I spoke, or to clergy generally. We've been much more conservative with regard to that. It's a position that I personally affirm with regard to being in ministry, particularly as rectors in parishes, to be the husband of one wife and to recognise the importance of reputation in the community. But that has slipped in other parts of the National Church. And where it was a universal principle at one time in the Anglican Church, it is no longer the case. And it's certainly not the case in America, for example. It's interesting, if you look at the Gene Robinson situation, the fact that he was divorced wasn't an issue at all. That was never raised as an issue. It was his relationship with his male partner. If we come on to fragile relationships and see the way in which these shared commitments but different understandings actually affect our relationships. In terms of female presbyters and female bishops, we have an impaired communion. That's a reality. It's a reality that Donald Robinson foretold back in the 1980s, and it's a reality which has practical consequences. The practical consequences are with regard to whereas if there's a priest or a bishop from another diocese and comes in to preach in our diocese, the courtesy is you get permission from the bishop or the archbishop, and the rector makes the invitation under those grounds, and everything's fine because we accept the orders, the communion of orders, as a recognition, whatever part of the National Church you come from, or whatever part of the Anglican Communion you come from. So we have two foreign bishops with us today, but they're accepted as us, and they could minister in our diocese. But when you have a female priest, because we don't recognise women in the priesthood, a female priest can't come into our diocese and actually exercise a ministry as a presbyter or as a priest. Likewise, a bishop, a female bishop, when she comes into our diocese, she can't exercise a ministry as a bishop. She can exercise a ministry as a deacon. We accept the orders of deacon, but we can't accept the orders of priest and bishop. That is difficult to comprehend from people outside Sydney, because from their point of view, they are a priest. When I was a bishop of North Sydney, we had a lady who was been ordained a priest in another diocese, And I said to her, what we'll do is, the Archbishop will license you as a deacon. And you in your own heart can think that you're a priest and no one's going to take that away from you, but your ministry is going to be as a deacon. And if you recognise that, because in our diocese there's no distinguishing vesture between a deacon and a priest. In other dioceses there is by the angle of your stole or scarf, but in our diocese we don't have those distinctions. But the distinction is with a bishop, of course, the episcopal habit of a bishop is different from the vestments for a priest or presbyter. So that's the reality. So when I spoke to Bishop Sarah McNeill when she became the Bishop of Grafton, tricky because I'm the Metropolitan and I had to affirm her canonical fitness for being Bishop of Grafton. The fact that I didn't think it was proper or appropriate for a woman to be a bishop of a diocese, I had a constitutional decision to make. Was she canonically fit? And since canonical fitness means you've been baptised, you've been ordained a priest and you're over 30 years of age... You're not supposed to ask a woman how old she is, but nonetheless, you have to sometimes. With regard to those three things, I could actually say, yes, those three things were true. Because although we would not see her as a priest in our diocese, the reality is she's been ordained a priest in another diocese. So if you agree to our holding our own view in our diocese, then you must allow another diocese to hold its own view too, which is constitutionally correct in terms of the 1960, in terms of the General Synod. So at that level, I did that, but I did not think that I could go because I would normally be the consecrating metropolitan in a situation like that, but I declined to do that, and the next senior bishop who was happy to do it, he did it in my place. So that was the way I handled that. We're consecrating Peter Lynn as a bishop for George River region in May, and the invitation has gone out to all the male bishops. And I've written to all the bishops who are women to indicate that this is on for their prayers. What I did was, when I became Archbishop, I wrote to all the female bishops, or bishops who are women, which is how they prefer to be referred to talk to them about my policy with regard to how we are courteous with people with whom we disagree. And so I developed a policy with their goodwill, not necessarily their agreement, they don't agree with my position, but with their goodwill as to how we do that. And I said to them, when we have a consecration of a bishop, what do I do? Because I don't want to invite you and then have to decline the invitation when you accept. So they said, well, let us know that it's on so we can pray. So that's what I'm doing. But impaired communion does have its difficulties. On the other side of impaired communion, because of the practice of diaconal administration in our diocese, which not all members of our diocese necessarily agree to, of course, but I would say the greater majority of our dioceses do. Our synod on two occasions, as you well know, have asserted that the Lord's Supper can be conducted by people other than a presbyter. So diaconal administration can become impaired communion for other dioceses. So the Archbishop of Melbourne now will ask deacons, if they're coming from Sydney, if they've conducted the Lord's Supper, in which case they're not welcome in the Diocese of Melbourne. So there's an edge that goes both ways with impaired communion. As we seek to do what we believe is biblical and is consistent with our heritage, it will have difficulties. With regard to sexuality, homosexuality in Christian ministry, we, of course, are well aware of all the things that took place in 2003 with Gene Robinson. But if you know the history, it was a long time before that that it was simmering in the United States and in Canada. In actual fact, Archbishop Goodhue went across as part of a commission to go and investigate what was happening in America, and he came back and said it was worse than he'd feared. And that was in 1999. The Gene Robinson situation was an eventual outcome of what was taking place in the mood change and the doctrinal change in North America. In our own country, we are told that there are people who are in same-sex relationships in ministry in the National Church. I'm told that. I don't know names, but that's what I'm told that exists. But our official position is no. But the Bishop of Gippsland, the late John McIntyre, in 2012 appointed the Reverend David Head as priest in charge in the parish of Hayfield. It was an interim arrangement, but nonetheless he was given a licence. David Head was in a same-sex relationship, and this caused a significant kerfuffle, as you can imagine, in the National Church and in the Diocese of Sydney. The Standing Committee expressed some views with regard to this. Correspondence went back and forth with myself and Bishop McIntyre, as well as with Dawson's secretary on behalf of the Standing Committee. And here we saw it looked like the beginning of the fracture of our own National Church. In March of that year, that was in February, in March of that year, the bishops met. And the bishops met, as we do every year, that's the national bishops, 42 of us, or thereabouts, diocesans and assistant bishops. And for the last 20 years or so, we've had a set of protocols with regard to our relationship one with another. For example, one protocol is that you can't take a clergyman from one diocese into another diocese if they've been in the position for less than 4 years. It's just it's a courtesy arrangement. Very few people know about these protocols. They're now actually publicly on the website, but they were just protocols for the bishops among themselves. Just relationships, relationships of courtesy, if you like. And what I've got on the back of that page, you'll see, under bishops' protocol, the following. There's about 25 of them. The following protocols express the common mind of the bishops as determined by consensus at our national meeting. Each protocol bears the date it was first agreed. We confirm our agreement to abide by them and renew this commitment annually by consensus. These protocols are voluntary agreements by the bishops for the exercise of their ministry. They are developed within the framework of the constitution and canons of the church and in the light of resolutions and statements made by the General Synod and its Standing Committee. While these protocols have no legislative force, it is expected that our bishops will abide by them as an expression of the bonds of affection and unity that we share in the gospel and our collegiality in episcopal ministry. The events of 2012, so for example, we did a protocol on women bishops before the first woman was consecrated a bishop. Of course, we knew that would be an issue we had to do, and that protocol, it's on the General Synod website if you want to look at it. I won't discuss it today. We developed a protocol. You've got Protocol 19, which is not the one. That was revised in 2014. Basically, what we did in 2012 was we said we want to adopt the position of Lambeth 110. If I use that as shorthand, the Lambeth 110 resolution of 1998, which basically said that homosexual practice is incompatible with the teaching of the Bible, although we would listen to the concerns of people who consider themselves to be homosexuals. Two statements there stand side by side. Depending on your position, you emphasise one or the other, in my experience. So we developed this protocol. There have been a number of resolutions of General Synod on homosexuality, which were all positive and conservative, and we put that in the protocol. And John McIntyre agreed to it. I spoke to him privately, and I said, well, what would you do if a situation like David Head came up again? And his response to me was, well, I never asked David Head what his personal arrangements were, which was probably the reason, it's because he knew the answer that he didn't ask the question, because he was an old friend. He actually studied at Ridley College with David Head. And he well knew of David Head's situation, because I knew that when Bishop John Wilson was inducting David Head into a church in Melbourne, this is decades before, I was told that at the induction service, at the welcome, David Head invited his male partner to stand on the platform with him and introduce him to the congregation. And the bishop was so overwhelmed and gobsmacked by this, He'd already given the license, so the fellow already had his appointment, couldn't withdraw it, and felt completely powerless in that situation, which he, of course, knew nothing about until that particular point in time. That was well known, so I'm told, in the Diocese of Melbourne, and I'm sure, I have no doubt, that John McIntyre did know that. However, John said that he would hold back for the sake of the unity of the bishops. That was his view and expressed. We had a difficult conversation with the national bishops with regard to that, but we came to that protocol and we agreed on it. And we decided to have the next bishops' conference talk about sexuality. It used the whole conference to talk about it. The next one in 2013, we did so, and that was a very worthwhile conference. People studied the scriptures and worked through the issues and came to a position where we found that we re-endorse the protocol. And every year we re-endorse the protocols. But come 2014, there was pressure. And so the pressure was, and in one sense, I can understand it. They said, if we latch onto 110 of Lambeth, we can never change that because that's a Lambeth resolution. It would require another Lambeth resolution to change 110. So therefore, there's no room for us to move. Now, at an objective level, that's a fair comment. We ought to be tying ourselves to the national church, not to Lambeth resolutions. So that's why we came up with the Protocol 19 on the back of your page at the bottom there. And we did this in 2014. And what we did, we tied it to faithfulness and service, where sexual activity is only to be held in marriage, defined as it currently is. As we ordain, license, or appoint to ministries within our diocese, we undertake to uphold faithfulness in service. The code of conduct for bishops adopted by the General Synod in Resolution 5904 and is amended by the General Synod from time to time. So it's a much shorter protocol, but it's still very clear, and that has held us together. Interestingly, with the death of John McIntyre, one of my regional bishops spoke to an archbishop who remained nameless, and he said, well, now the pressure's gone away. And the archbishop said, oh no, the pressure hasn't gone away at all. In other words, it's still back in there in the background. That will be a pressure point which, in my view, is so great that it would cause us to rethink our association with the Anglican Church of Australia. If a bishop was to break this protocol, and realise it's not legislative. We agree to it every year. We just had our meeting early this month, and we agreed to all the protocols once again. But it only takes one bishop to break that protocol, and they could do it quite legally, as it were. Well, it may be not in terms of the protocol. It could be seen as unlawful in terms of our fundamental declarations, in my opinion. But if they do that, we will find ourselves in a far greater sense of fracture. We are fragile at the moment, in my opinion, but a greater sense of fracture. I'm looking at the time and I'm going to go on a bit. I don't want to go on too long. Church planting and the gospel is the next area, and there's a structures and viability report at the General Synod came in 2014. I won't say much about that, but church planting, you realise the word church planting outside our diocese is a negative term. Church planting means someone's coming into my patch to plant a church. I don't think church planting has by its nature that negative connotation, but nonetheless, that's what people think. That's why they use the term fresh expressions, the task force, when that was developed in the General Synod. One of the problems with the viability report, and our own standing committee has given a response to this report, is that it really doesn't see the gospel as the most important feature of viability. It talks about all kinds of other things whereby you might patch things up, as it were, or amalgamate dioceses and make them easier or whatever it might be, or divide dioceses which are too big, like certain ones around the Sydney Basin. But nonetheless, the gospel is not at the heart of that report. That, I think, is the great flaw. But I'll leave that, and you can read the Standing Committee report if you like. A possible future. A new paradigm for describing the Anglican landscape. Let me read to you a report from the Diocese of Brisbane, ostensibly a Catholic diocese, a liberal Catholic diocese. And this was written by Bishop Jonathan Holland, and he wrote these words and was endorsed by the bishop and council. An evangelical or a Catholic theology has historically shaped a diocese, perhaps Melbourne being the single exception where both theologies operate. One legacy has been to entrench suspicion between dioceses of different theologies. More could have been said about this. He's talking about the viability report. Because the Catholic evangelical divide seems now to be changing. And one wonders what that might signify for viability, restructuring, unity and mission. In the future, we may no longer see Catholic dioceses and evangelical dioceses, so much as we'll see conservative evangelical dioceses and liberal evangelical dioceses, the dividing line being acceptance or rejection of the ordination of women to the priesthood, he means, with Catholic dioceses as a third and much weaker component in the Australian Anglican Church. Many former Catholic dioceses are now much more evangelical in character. Canberra-Goulburn, Northwest Australia, Tasmania, and Adelaide, while the Catholic dioceses of Bathurst, the Northern Territory, and Rockhampton have all recently elected bishops whose theological roots are in evangelicalism. The effect of this transition from Catholic to many more evangelical dioceses may well be to bring greater resolution to the single issue that has compromised hopes for greater national Anglican unity down the decades, theological aversion between Catholic and evangelical. A very interesting reflection from outside our diocese, that he sees that the growth in dioceses and the change of leadership to people, to more evangelical bishops, is a game changer in the national church. Anglo-Catholicism as a group is a very shrinking minority in our national church. Liberal Catholics, if you like, they are also a shrinking group. Liberals don't have a robust gospel whereby they can multiply. Liberals grow by being from disaffected evangelicals. That's how they grow their numbers. So that's an interesting. Jonathan told me privately. He said he sees. He said to me, his type. He called himself a liberal Catholic. His grouping is going to diminish. I invited him to change, of course, and come and join us, rather than being all by himself, but he declined. His father is a bishop, and he told me his father loves that he's retired here. He loves the Diocese of Sydney, and his father would describe himself more as an evangelical now than he was a liberal when he was a bishop, when he was Bishop of Newcastle. So that's the changing landscape. There's a renewed alignment of evangelicals. That can be seen in General Synod. One, because of our numbers in General Synod. The Diocese of Sydney is nearly a quarter of the General Synod and numbers, and that's very scary for the rest of the National Church. What they don't see is, why would anyone think that our politics is the reason why we're growing? It's nothing to do with our politics, it's to do with our gospel. It's our commitment to the Scriptures and to the glory of God and the gospel of Jesus Christ that we want to see people saved. And if we see people saved and people are saved, our numbers grow. It's interesting, in the National Church, there are only three dioceses who have sufficient clergy to fill positions. Northwest Australia, Armidale and Sydney. And they're your three prominent evangelical dioceses. So there is an issue. Standing committee, it surprised a great number of people, perhaps even surprised ourselves, that the evangelicals on standing committee are now virtually in the majority. Certainly in the lay positions, where the Sydney ticket, if you like, or the evangelical ticket at General Synod won the day in a clean sweep. And I beg your pardon, the clergy, sorry, wrong way around. Sorry, the clergy, thank you. It was the clergy in the clean sweep, and the lay was more different, but even the lay, there are a number of evangelicals. So there's a changing landscape there, which is significant. I think the formation of the Fellowship of Confessing Anglicans next week in Melbourne is another significant feature. I had a number of bishops come up to me at the Bishops' Conference saying, what are you hoping to achieve from this? And the Archbishop of Melbourne spoke to Richard Conde, and he wanted to speak at the FCA. And Richard Conde said, yes, but you can't subscribe to the Jerusalem Declaration. And he said, well, it'd be good I'd like to speak. So he's going to address and welcome the people at the FCA. Well, of course, that upset people in Melbourne. So there was a motion in Melbourne, or a question in Melbourne Synod, why was the Archbishop of Melbourne going to the FCA? So there's obviously anxiety beneath the surface for lots of people here. Well, my last point is the recognition of the smell of death. While there's death, there's hope. It's when you realise the church is dying, when you realise that the demographics are really 70 plus. We used to say 60 plus. It's now 70 plus across the national church. When you look at the average size church around Australia is 50 people. And when you add in all the congregations around the country, that's a pretty scary statistic. And it's only, and some bishops recognize, see the problem and are reaching out. One of the things that we in the Diocese of Sydney can do, in my view, is export more clergy. If more of our clergy were willing to sacrifice the comfort of a Sydney stipend and a Sydney lifestyle, move outside the Diocese of Sydney into other parts of Australia, we could do a great good for the gospel in our nation as a whole. So that's something that is part of my prayers, and I hope might be part of your prayers as well. I've come to the end of my time, and I think, Gav, we have time for questions.
Please bring your questions forward and put up your hand and ask them, and I'm sure Glenn will be only too happy to answer. Laurie.
Very rarely do people outside the diocese come in to conduct Holy Communion. They normally come to preach. That's the norm. However, with regard to the woman who was a priest that I mentioned when I was Bishop of North Sydney, I said, and with the Archbishop's approval, of course, I said, you could conduct communion under your licence as a deacon. You would be conducting communion in your own persona as a priest. If you were happy to do that with a license as a deacon, I would be happy about that. She was sceptical at first. She thought, what's your hidden agenda? And I said, I don't work with hidden agendas. I'll say as it is. And so she did. Conduct communion.
Okay.
No, I have heard that visiting female bishops have come with cope and mitre, and when that's come to my attention, I've told them that the polity of the diocese is mitres are not worn by bishops, and so therefore they shouldn't be dressed as a bishop.
Since told
the opposite in terms of I'm supposed to wear a mitre. No, I've been told I should be wearing a petrol cross, but no. Well, they can tell me that. I like to wear legal garments.
Another question?
Archbishop, I have two questions. Archbishop, I have three questions.
Well, which one is it? Is it Mayor 5? In February 2012, there was no protocol, so he didn't break the protocol. The question is, did he break faithfulness and service? On an interpretation, yes. One of the problems about faithfulness and service is, although it is a national code of conduct for the Anglican Church of Australia, it has to be adopted by each diocese, and each diocese adopts it, sometimes in a slightly different form than other dioceses.
Am I right then in assuming that Melbourne was powerless to discipline him in any way?
When you say Melbourne, you mean the illustration I gave with Bishop Wilson? Or you mean Gippsland? Oh, do you mean the Metropolitan?
Yes.
The Metropolitan would be powerless, yes, unless he chose to bring a charge before the tribunal. That would be the only power the Metropolitan would have.
My fourth question is, given that you moving far more tender diplomatic service than I do, and given that you illustrated how fragile our unity is with the National Church, fragile in some doctrinal areas that we find deeply offensive, is the unity worth maintaining?
One of the interesting things about those of a liberal Catholic theology is that unity is highly prized. Therefore, they will restrain themselves for the sake of unity. Evangelicals prize unity, but prize doctrinal orthodoxy at a greater level than unity. And evangelicals don't believe that structural unity is the consequence of John 17, but spiritual unity, and that the unity actually already exists. In my view, Jesus' prayer has been answered. We are one. How we maintain that unity is the issue. So to answer your question, as long as they restrain themselves, the unity can be apparent. But there are deep fissures in their theological commitments, which they only rarely bring to the surface. Okay? Sure. I think they have restrained themselves publicly. To be fair, the previous Bishop of Rockhampton, when we raised these issues about, in this case, the issue was extended communion. Because we were talking about, who's going to do communion, etc. And he used to have lay people do extended communion across his diocese. He stopped all that. And he did it at great cost to himself because there was a backlash. But he was trying to maintain the unity of the National Church. This was not an accepted practice in our National Church. So there are people of integrity like that. And a lot of the bishops do have integrity like that. So I wouldn't want to read into their motives at all. But so you have to wait for it to come. Some people don't ask questions. On the sexuality issue, they just don't ask questions. They don't like to ask questions. Whether they know the answer or not, they don't like to ask questions. Whereas we are much more open and robust or less subtle in the questions that we ask. Okay?
Peter.
Good questions. In essence, they last until they're repealed, but they're reaffirmed every year. It's not that they have a 12-month life existence or a use-by date, but what we do is we confirm them every year. If you're not present, you're still bound. And if you want to change the protocol, you have to give 3 months' notice. Okay, so people say you can't spring on the meeting, oh, I'm not going to vote for this, or I want it changed, etc. So you've got 3 months' notice, so that everyone knows. It's a way so we can manage our relationships. And I have to say, the relationships among the bishops are actually at a very good level, so we can have these honest conversations, which I think is good.
Thank you.
Muriel Porter said after the last General Synod that the change in General Synod would mean that we would never get women priests through the Synod, through legislation today. And I think that's right. They're scared. And I think that in one sense you could say that when Donald Robinson became Archbishop, he was very pro the Constitution because his mindset was constitutional. Even though he was opposed to it coming in, having lost that battle, he even went to the courts about it, he went to the Parliament with regard to it, he lost the battle, so therefore he would work within the Constitution. And I think that where the Constitution is an advantage to us, it has... I mean, Donald Cameron described it as the ability of its fluidity and ability to change things was like a steamroller with permanently locked gears. That was his illustration, and I think that's kind of true. But we have made changes, the Diocese of Sydney has made changes. So I can think of a number of things where members of the bishops from Sydney have made changes in protocols, been on drafting groups, and have actually benefited the national church because of that, which we couldn't do if we were outside. So I think there's still value in being in the national church, and I would like to, if it comes to the fracture that I talked about, the first point of fracture would be to remove the other parties, not us remove. Yes, it is. It is. And a lot of it's to do with with having evangelical bishops. Yeah, that's a big change.
I think we've got time for two more questions.
So what do you see the role of the ACL is in the Buddha Bishop? What do you see our role, or is there a role?
The ACL's role in Sydney is to keep the diocese evangelical. That's our role. Our role is to be ever vigilant, if you like, the RSL, an ecclesiastical RSL, ever vigilant with regard to, because you can slip because you just accept it, or the next generation, you know, one generation fights for it, the next generation accepts it, and the third one forgets it. So we want to be ever vigilant at that level. The stronger ACL is, the stronger the Diocese of Sydney is. The stronger the Diocese of Sydney is, the better the National Church will be. That's my view of the powers of persuasion. Okay? Thank you. We are working at it in various ways. One of the great things we've learned, particularly through CMS, is cross-cultural ministry. And what you have to realise, when you leave the Diocese of Sydney, you're entering into cross-cultural ministry when you go to another diocese, the way they do things, their synod rules, their dress. So therefore, it requires people with cross-cultural skills to do it well. If I can say Mark Calder is a great ambassador for Sydney in the parish of Noosa, in the Diocese of Brisbane. And the Archbishop of Brisbane thinks he's wonderful. He's a strong evangelical, and he's turned that church around. The Archbishop of Brisbane won't let him have more college graduates. So he has to take them from St. Francis. So he's got to work hard with developing the assistance that he's got. So he's working under that duress, but he's still making headway. One, gospel and growth in his parish, but his stature in the synod, and when he speaks, his voice is listened to and not derided, as evangelicals might be in other places. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you. I should add from personal experience, it's possible to go to a diocese outside of Sydney and actually come back with stronger convictions, even if that diocese is not as evangelical as Sydney. So, well, thank you very much, Glenn. Thank you for giving us the groundwork for the Australian situation here. It just raises a lot more questions in my mind, but also has answered some questions and also sets us up for the rest of the day. We are going to now have morning tea over that side of Chapter House and then come back here at 10:30 and listen to Ashley Null. So please join for morning tea.